It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Program that challenges tired popular talking points. The program which doesn't tell you what to think and instead just encourages you to think on your own. For example, the debate over intelligent design. Now, this is a debate that is not going to be settled anytime soon, although I am convinced that nature does point to some kind of intelligent design. Others are not so convinced. This is fine. People are entitled to their opinions. Let the debate continue. Which leads us to the real problem today. Many do not want a debate. For some reason, they feel classrooms are meant for one view and one view only. Debates threaten them. Not that they'll admit to being threatened. Instead, they will say that the subject of God is a religious subject, appropriate for church perhaps, but not a science class. Supposedly, God is all about blind faith. I believe people are missing the point. If God exists, and just for the sake of this conversation, I did say if God exists, then he is a real entity, and he is involved with the rest of reality. He and the universe he created constitute reality. My friends, isn't science supposed to be studying reality? The purpose of science is not to merely repeat facts, but to also search for facts. If not for this search, if not for theories being put forth and defended or challenged, we would have no scientific data at all. If some scientists see evidence for a creator and they feel they can defend this evidence, and there are many in this camp, they feel they can defend this through empirical data rather than blind faith, why should they be denied opportunity to do so? I'll tell you why. People are assuming from the onset that God does not exist, and of course there is no way they can be certain of this as an established actual fact. If they were less arrogant, if they were less sure of their unchecked position, if they were more open, then the question of God would be a legitimate scientific question. In other words, if they could lay aside their faith, we could have a real discussion. People love to talk about the days when evolution was a forbidden subject in our puritanistic, old-fashioned, narrow-minded schools. Well, who is being narrow-minded now? I say let the debate go on. If proponents of intelligent design are really so foolish, they should be easy to disprove. Why do people feel the need to resort to censorship, the very tactics they renounced when evolution was forbidden? This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
So, you'd like to believe in God, but you feel it would be a waste of time to follow a God who may not even exist. And even if there were some kind of God, how do we know he's the God of the Bible? There are all kinds of religions, and they all make contradictory claims about who God is. Well, my friend, you're asking some excellent questions. It's true that establishing the existence of some kind of generic God in the cosmos somewhere does not immediately offer any conclusions about him being the God described in the Bible. But I have found, interestingly enough, that when I debate atheists, the Bible is the primary document that they take issue with. Having said that, for today, let's back up, begin with some kind of God, God with the capital G, the generic God, and then move a little bit into the Bible. Obviously, authenticating both the existence of God and the accuracy of Scripture, which claims to be his word revealed over thousands of years, well, those are major subjects which need abundant detail. On future programs, we will supply such detail, I promise. But for today, I merely want to provide a taste. I want to whet your appetite. Welcome to our sanctuary, a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters, a place where you can express your opinions and still be treated with respect. Every question I am about to read to you right now and respond to right now was either emailed to me by listeners or brought up over the air live on past shows with a call-in question, or perhaps asked me in person on college campuses. I do appreciate these questions very much. I used to ask a lot of the same questions myself, and I have a great deal of respect for those who pose them today. As a matter of fact, I myself was an atheist for many years and then an agnostic for 2 years prior to giving my life to God through Jesus Christ. And so let's get into it. First question, great place to start. Can the existence of God be proved? If you've heard previous shows or read any of my writings or books, you realize that I constantly say that God's existence cannot be proven or disproved. Instead of claiming to prove the existence of God, Christians and other theists should offer evidence. I define evidence as that which points to a high probability that a given claim is true. I define proof as something we can observe with our own senses. In science, nothing is proven unless it is repeatable. Since none of us were there when the universe came into existence, we cannot prove or disprove God. There is, however, another definition of proof, a different kind of proof, that of an observable working equation. Let me say this as carefully as I can. If we want to use this mathematical definition, then there is a proof for the existence of God. At the moment, once again, we are not talking about the God of the Bible. That's a whole different subject where we would have to study historical evidence for those kinds of conclusions. But the proof for some type of deity? Sure. Absolutely. In fact, it's really quite simple. Something had to always exist. You can't get something out of nothing. This something had to be a personality. Not a human being necessarily, but some kind of thinking, feeling, sentient being. Why do I say that? Because otherwise there is no explanation for the origin of personality. This is the fundamental hurdle in the field of artificial intelligence. Can a computer ever become self-aware? Is it possible to recreate the brain with its ability to think? Can sentience be produced in the laboratory? Only time will answer these questions, but meanwhile, they beg the much bigger question. Since stars and rocks and dust cannot think, and since chemicals outside the chemicals of the brain in harmony with the rest of the brain, since they cannot think, where did personality come from? Do we get the personal from the personal, or do we get the personal from the impersonal? Now, we can add it up just like an equation. 0 + 0 = 0. We could just as easily say 0 × 0 = 0, but let's stick with the plus. If something had to always exist, if you can't get something out of nothing, if the personal must come from the personal, then this something which always existed is some kind of eternal personality. We have offered, not according to the observable scientific method, but according to the philosophical mathematical method, we have just offered a proof for the existence of God. I know that went by very fast. I'm sure you're thinking too fast, like some kind of card trick or sleight of hands. As I said, in future shows, we will go back and re-explore and supply all kinds of detail and deal with the nuances and the objections and the questions. But just for today's purposes, let's move on now and talk about what kind of God he is. I guess some of you would say, what kind of God is he or she or it? And we will move a little bit into the Bible now, because the Bible does say things about God. And sometimes the Bible's descriptions of God's abilities, those abilities themselves are objected to. And here's one, I'm sure you've heard this zillion times. I know I have. Can God really do anything? If so, can he create a rock so huge that not even he can push it? Again, this is not an original question. As a matter of fact, the question may be as old as God itself. Still, some people think that when they pose the question, I'm going to fall out of my chair because I never heard it before. They may even believe they're quite clever just for asking it, but I also know that people ask it sincerely. I do not mean to generalize all skeptics. Certainly, some are very sincere when they pose questions. But again, some are arrogant. So, but whatever kind you are, we're here to address it today. And my answer is going to surprise you. Hold on to your seat. No, God cannot do anything. There, I said it. Christians will be as startled as anyone else by such a response. It's true that the Bible rejoices in God's marvelous abilities, which are so far beyond ours that the ancient Hebrews, in their hyperbole, often spoke of God's omnipotence. However, when the Bible tells us that God can do anything, it means God can do anything that's possible to do. That even includes miracles. They may be beyond our limited understanding, but God knows things about science that we have not attained, obviously. So yes, God does miracles because it's possible for him to do miracles. Not possible for us, but possible for him. And yet, some things are, believe it or not, impossible even for God. Don't forget, this same Bible goes out of its way to teach that God can never be evil. In fact, he cannot even be tempted by evil. Doesn't this make sense? Can God be 100% good and 100% evil at the same time? No, he can't. That a good God cannot be an evil God is rather obvious, but even if we wanted to enter this discussion with moral neutrality, such a phenomenon could never exist according to sheer logic alone. How can any being be 100% of one thing and 100% of something opposite at the same time? It's like saying the color of blood is 100% red and 100% green, paying homage to the Vulcans. The same holds true for the rock illustration. It posits a God who can do anything and then, in his omnipotence, arranges matters so that he cannot do anything. C.S. Lewis, the brilliant philosopher, author, and Christian apologist, gave the best answer I have ever heard for this kind of question. I could not improve on him, so let me just quote him. Nonsense is nonsense, even when we are talking about God. Let's move on. Other abilities of God described in the Bible which people take issue with. This is a really good one. We've all asked this. How can God exist without beginning or end? If God created us, who created God? Would not he himself have to have a beginning and an end? This is a fair question, and I have an interesting answer for you to consider. The need for a beginning and an end is necessary only within the boundaries of time and space. The Bible portrays God as being completely removed from time and space. For this reason, God will not have a beginning or an end. The existence of something beyond time and its limitations is a serious, ongoing discussion today in the field of physics. But the Bible explored this issue over 2,000 years ago. I'm reading from 2 Peter chapter 3. The Apostle Peter said, "But do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow about keeping his promises." Some understand slowness. He was talking there about people claiming that they were expecting the second coming of Jesus. They thought it should have happened by now. But the point I want to make right here is the way Peter describes God in time. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. Since it is impossible for one 24-hour day to be 1,000 years, at the same time as 1,000 years is one 24-hour day. Peter's obvious intention is to say that to God, time is completely irrelevant. Humans are limited by time. God is not. The Apostle John tells us something similar in the book of Revelation while relaying a vision loaded with symbolism. One of the symbols for Jesus is the figure of a lamb, Revelation 13, the lamb who was slain from the creation of the world, John says. Now, of course, historically, Jesus died on the cross in 33 AD, not prior to creation. But from God's point of view, from God's vantage point, the event had already happened because he sits outside of time, seeing everything all at once. And so, existing in eternity rather than the confines of time and space, God need not have a beginning or an end. Here's another good question. Do the abilities of God as described in the Bible contradict scientific law? Doesn't the idea that God created the universe completely destroy scientific law as we know it? My friend, which scientific law? There is no law in science explaining how the universe came into being. All we know is that our universe had a beginning. Nobody can say with any certainty exactly what started the Big Bang. Now, there are scientific laws which govern the operation of the universe, which leads to an even better question. How can we have a law without a lawmaker? Here's another one. I love this one. Why do Christians need to insist on one God? Why can't there be many gods? My friend, there's nothing wrong with the idea of multiple gods as a concept. It's just that this is not the reality of the situation. If we happened to live in a universe created by many gods, that would have been fine. But we don't. Instead, we exist in a universe brought about by one God. This is the teaching of the Bible. As for reasons to accept the Bible as the Word of God, once again, a separate discussion. But according to the Bible, the way that question would be answered is, there just happens to be one God. Now, this next one is extremely important because it flies in the face of the way many popular ideas and other religions portray God. So let's get this clear. Does the Bible teach that God created everything or that God is everything? When the Bible uses the word God, it means a thinking, feeling entity who created the universe and who holds each of us accountable for our lives. There's a much different, very popular idea about God, the notion that God and the universe are one and the same thing. In other words, God is everything. This idea, commonly called pantheism, is gaining quite a following in modern religious thought, even though its roots are ancient, some of them going back to certain sects of Hinduism. A Christian says God made that tree. A pantheist says God is the tree. Now, there are different strains of pantheism. Some insist that the God universe is a non-personal phenomenon. The universe doesn't think. The universe just is. It is almost like saying there's no God at all. There's only existence. Other pantheists will claim that the God slash universe does have a personality. This view suggests that the oceans, rivers, stars, planets somehow make up one collective sentient being. All right, we live in a country that guarantees freedom of religion, and I would never want to see that change. I respect the rights and sincerity of people who have a different view of God, be it pantheist or any other belief. At the same time, all too often, we tend to give religious ideas a free pass without taking the time to question them according to logic or authentication. The first logical observation is that one cannot claim to follow the Bible and accept pantheism at the same time, although many do just exactly that. The Bible clearly distinguishes God from creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. A familiar verse to be sure, but the role of God as creator was taught throughout Scripture, both Old Testament and New Testament. I'm reading from Job 38. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. This is God talking to Job. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? The Apostle Paul talking about God in Romans chapter 1. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. As you see, the Bible does say that we can learn some things about the Creator from His creation. But it is still called creation, meaning there was a time when the universe did not exist and God brought it into being. As I already alluded, the Bible teaches that our Creator will hold us accountable for the way we live our lives, distinguishing God once again from one of His creations, distinguishing Him from the human race. Acts 17, "For He has set a day when He will judge the world with justice." Of course, being consistent with the Bible is only one part of our logical quest. We can also ask if the Bible's view of God makes more sense than the pantheist view of God. Does it make sense that design implies a designer? The human body is a far more complicated machine than any computer or automobile. We would have trouble imagining such machines coming into existence by mere accident. According to pantheist view 1, the universe, which some call God, is impersonal. Who then designed its complexity? And how do we account for human personality, something we already explored at the top of this program? We have previously established we cannot get the personal from the impersonal. As for the idea of a God who holds us accountable, is it not consistent with our very own societies? Don't we have laws and courts to prevent anarchy? Don't we forbid people to selfishly hurt others? A good case can be made that we drew up such laws because we have a conscience inside, condemning evil and making us feel guilty if we aren't making an effort to treat others in a way that we ourselves would want to be treated. Where did this conscience come from? Does it not bear witness to an accountability to the very Creator who programmed it into our DNA? Now, moving on, according to pantheist view 2, this conscience would merely be a part of the eternal conscience of the universe. But if God is everything, then He is also everybody, including evil people. This would make God Himself evil, or at least partly evil. So Adolf Hitler is part of God, Idi Amin is part of God, Saddam Hussein is part of God. I think you get my point about how illogical that is. Our final question for today, don't extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence? This is not only a question, it's a statement. It's been given to me over the air often by my atheist friends. Extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. Very familiar slogan, repeated often. Whenever I speak of the historical validity of the resurrection, I point out that if the same amount of eyewitnesses and historians who claim Jesus rose from the dead merely claim that Jesus gave a speech or started a revolution, no serious scholar or historian would doubt it. Usually my skeptical friends do not refute the comment. Instead, they smile and say, extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. In other words, maybe there are a lot of eyewitnesses for the resurrection, and maybe that would be valid evidence if Jesus merely gave a speech or started a revolution. But claiming that He rose from the dead, well, we've got to have more evidence than what a historian would usually look for. Extraordinary claims, such as the resurrection, need extraordinary evidence. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I tend to resist that phrase. To me, either we have evidence or we don't. It's either good evidence or it isn't. Our process for examining historical evidence must be objective. If we are going to begin with the bias that miracles are impossible, then no amount of evidence, no matter how extraordinary the evidence, no amount of evidence will ever be enough. Now then, let us leave the field of history for a moment and venture back into science, another discipline where people believe they have dismissed God once and for all. I said at the top of the program, nothing in science is proven unless it's repeatable and observable. Now, according to microevolution, changes within the same species. Microevolution can be observed. Macroevolution, changes from one species to another, are not being observed. Neither would an evolutionist make such a claim, since it would take millions of years, in his opinion, for that to happen. Evolution does not merely teach that man came from ape-like creatures. It teaches that all species were once related. Birds, reptiles, mammals, fish, all related. If this is really true, we should find literally billions upon billions of missing link fossils. Knowing that we don't even come remotely close, evolutionists still point to a handful of alleged fossils, very disputed amongst certain paleontologists. Nevertheless, they cling to these findings as clear, abundant evidence for macro evolution at this point. I just have to make a simple observation. Claiming that all species were once related is an extraordinary claim. What happened to extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence? Well, if all this did was make you question and think about things, my objective for today has been accomplished. I understand that in one brief program, I'm not going to necessarily change minds. We will, of course, continue exploring these very important questions on future shows. Thank you so much for joining us today. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too.